It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
I'm Tyrus.
I'm Ainsley Earhart.
I'm Trey Gowdy, and this is the Fox News Rundown.
Thursday, March 7th, 2024. I'm Dave Anthony. President Biden goes prime time tonight, delivering a State of the Union address in an election year ahead of a likely Trump rematch. But it's not supposed to be a campaign speech.
He's supposed to appear as a statesman. I mean, you've got all the pomp and circumstance of the presidency, all the power of the bully pulpit. You know, you don't degrade that through pure politicization.
And Lisa Brady. Some progressive policies are falling by the wayside in liberal areas. But is it permanent or just politics?
It's pretty amazing what an election season will do to politicians who have previously spent a lot of their political capital moving us in a direction that I think a lot of people would say has undermined policing and public safety.
And I'm Jason Chaffetz. I've got the final word on the Fox News Rundown.
Well, it's that time of year when Congress gathers for the State of the Union address, something that dates back to 1913, when President Woodrow Wilson started a new tradition, delivering the speech in person. Up till then, presidents only delivered a written report annually, as mandated by the Constitution. Last year, President Biden said,
"Under my plans, as long as I'm president, nobody earning less than $400,000 will pay an additional penny in taxes. Nobody, not one penny."
And tonight, it's expected he'll focus on his efforts to lower prescription drug costs and protect Americans' freedoms, in particular abortion rights, a key issue for Democrats. And this year, it may feel even more like a campaign speech, with former President Trump's last Republican challenger, Nikki Haley, dropping out of the race.
"It is now up to Donald Trump to earn the votes of those in our party and beyond it who did not support him. And I hope he does that."
So, President Biden goes on primetime TV tonight with a Trump rematch, a near certainty.
Well, the State of the Union is always important because it is the most watched speech that a president gives.
Mark Thiessen is a Washington Post columnist, a fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, and a Fox News contributor, and he knows all about the State of the Union. He was the lead speechwriter for two of President George W. Bush's addresses.
Upwards of 20 million to 30 million people tune in and watch this speech every year. And it's a critical opportunity for Joe Biden in that he is the most unpopular president in the history of presidential polling, and is going into an election in a few months behind Donald Trump, with Americans deeply disapproving of his policies. And so he has to ask them for a reset and make a case for himself.
Now that the Trump-Biden rematch appears inevitable, Nikki Haley dropping out of the race the day before the State of the Union, does that affect this at all? I mean, the Biden campaign's been reaching out to Haley supporters suddenly after this dropout. I mean, does he mention her tonight? What does he do?
His focus shouldn't be on Donald Trump. It shouldn't be on the Republicans. It should be on the trying to convince the American people to give him a chance for a second term. And the problem he faces is that what Biden tends to do is he tends to tell the American people that things are better than you seem to think they are. Does anyone think the State of the Union is strong? Every president says that in their State of the Union address, but I don't think, you know, 65% of Americans think the country's headed in the wrong direction. I think 43% plurality of Americans say Biden's policies have made their lives worse. And so if you say things to the American people that don't comport with their lived reality, they just tune you out and you look ridiculous.
You said that this is the most watched speech. So maybe he could convince some of these people that they've just heard the wrong message about the economy, that if they just pay attention to his accomplishments on climate initiatives, hey, job growth's been terrific since he took over after the pandemic, that inflation's come down a lot since its spike in 2022. Do you think that that would work?
No, because people know what's going on in their own family finances. Credit card debt just topped $1 trillion for the first time in history. So if you're an American, you look at Joe Biden's inflation and you see that you went from having a savings account that was full of cash to maxing out your credit cards. And now he says, well, now inflation's, better. It's like, I'm sorry, but I'm maxed out on my Visa and my MasterCard and my Discover card in order to pay for the inflation of the last 3 years. I'm not giving you credit because finally it's slowed. And the prices, by the way, haven't come down. They've just stopped growing as fast. You know, you have to always take into account the lived reality of the people who are listening to what you're saying. If you talk about your foreign policy successes, they see that there are wars raging in the Middle East. They see there's a war raging in Europe. They see American ships being fired on with impunity by Iranian-backed rebels and terrorist groups. They see Americans being killed in the Middle East and nothing being done about it. So, you know, they see with their eyes what's going on in the world. You can't tell people, don't believe your lying eyes. Everything's really great. Right. Things aren't great. No one thinks the State of the Union is strong.
On that note, there are always invited guests at the State of the Union speech. The president sometimes honors them by name and they get praised and cheered by members of Congress. Well, lawmakers also have their own guests. I want you to listen to Michael McCaul, the Republican chair, the House Foreign Affairs Committee. This is what he told Fox.
Well, I'm taking the Christy Shamwan, whose daughter, Nicole Gee, was killed by a suicide bomber at Abbey Gate in Afghanistan. As you know, I am conducting a thorough investigation as to what happened in Afghanistan.
Now, Mark, that troop withdrawal that went so wrong in 2021 is further in the rearview mirror now. You talked about, you know, the Gaza and there's Ukraine. The terror attack that killed 13 American service members, I imagine the president won't even bring that up tonight, right?
He won't bring it up, but actually, Congressman McCaul is right in the sense that it is the reason why he's going to lose the election. And I'll tell you why. I don't think very many voters are going to walk into the voting booth thinking about the Afghan withdrawal. But that was the moment when Joe Biden's numbers tanked. Before the Afghan withdrawal, he had been above 50% approval in every single poll. And it was only after the Abbey Gate bombing and the withdrawal from Afghanistan and all the lies he told Americans and telling Americans that it was a huge success and that no one advised him to keep troops and all the rest of this, all of a sudden his approval tanked and it never recovered. And on top of that, his numbers for the poll started showing that people thought he was incompetent. All of this started in Afghanistan.
He's our oldest president ever. Here he is addressing the nation prime time, 9 o'clock p.m. Eastern time and beyond. You have been a speechwriter. You wrote as a lead two of these State of the Union speeches for President George W. Bush. How would you handle that tonight? Because it's the elephant in the room, right? People are going to be watching to see, is he going to stumble? Is he going to look old? All that.
Here's the problem is that there's not really a good way you can handle it. Ronald Reagan handled the age issue by making fun of himself. He used to joke, I've given strict orders that if there's ever a crisis, that people should wake me up, even if it's in the middle of a cabinet meeting. he said, I'm not going to make my opponent's youth and inexperience an issue in this campaign. The reason he was able to do that is because it was morning in America. Because things were going well in the country. No one would care about Joe Biden's age or his stiffened gait or whatever if the economy was humming and the border was under control and crime was under control and peace was breaking out all over the world. But it's not. The border is in chaos. The economy is not doing great, as in the estimation of most Americans. Crime is everywhere. And, you know, the world is on fire. And so that's why people are concerned about his age. And so there's nothing, you know, speechwriters are talented, but we're not miracle workers. there's no clever line you can come up with to contextualize all that.
Now, you dealing with this speech, let's just go to how long does this take to put together?
Oh, my gosh. Months. You start working on, our State of the Union addresses, if I recall, were a little bit sooner than this.
Yeah. Well, this is the latest State of the Union speech ever.
We would start outlining the speech after Thanksgiving. We'd present the president with an outline roughly before Christmas. And then in January, we'd start writing for January. As soon as we got back after New Year, start writing in earnest. After a few weeks, he put it through the White House staffing process, which is an opportunity for everybody to comment on it. And that's enormous task in a State of the Union address because everybody wants to get their line.
That has to be frustrating. That has to be hard.
It is. And then you sort of fend off that. Then you have meetings in the Oval Office of the president where he decides what to put in, what not to put in. He starts editing the speech. And then once you got a draft that he's happy with, you go to the family theater in the residence. They have a movie theater down on the first floor of the residence. And they set up a lectern and a teleprompter in there. And he starts practicing the speech. And those start out as editing sessions. But over time, he doesn't want any more edits. He's just practicing and memorizing and working on delivery. And, you know, by the time the president delivers it, he's been, you know, he's delivered it probably 20 times.
Do revisions happen up until the last day? Could they?
Every president is different. There was one State of the Union where Bill Clinton actually, they had been working on it so late that they loaded the wrong speech into the teleprompter. For the first 10 minutes, he just ad-libbed the State of the Union. Got the right speech.
That would be really, really, that would not necessarily go well if that happened to President Biden tonight.
I don't think that would be a recoverable moment for him, no.
Now that we have talked about what you think the president can't do, right, about he can't tell people what they think is different.
Mm-hmm.
It is a campaign year. Why not do, I mean, there's reporting that he is going to go after former President Trump. And he's going to try to make him go crazy. You know, he thinks that the former president's wobbly, intellectually, emotionally, and dangerous and unpopular. Maybe just make it a campaign speech and go after Trump. Can he do that?
The problem is the State of the Union address isn't a campaign speech. He's supposed to appear as a statesman. I mean, you've got all the pomp and circumstance of the presidency, all the power of the bully pulpit. You know, you don't degrade that through pure politicization. So I'll say a perfect example is aid to Ukraine. If you're looking at it from a campaign perspective and you want to hit them for not supporting the Ukrainians, which the majority of Americans do, then you do what he did in that press conference a few weeks ago, where he says the Republicans in Congress need to decide: are they with freedom or are they with the Russian tyrant? Are they with the Ukrainian people or are they with Donald Trump? And you sort of attack the Republicans. That's not going to help get aid passed. If you were approaching it as a statesman who wants to get aid passed, what you do is you say the Republican Party has a long history of supporting freedom fighters around the world. Ronald Reagan stood at this rostrum, 30 years ago and called on Congress to support freedom fighters across the world who are fighting Russian expansionism. And I call on the Republican Party to live up to that great history and that great tradition when we united as a party to confront Russian expansionism. Let's do it together. This is a cause that's bigger than partisanship. This is a cause that's important for the peace of the world and the security of the American people. So it'll be very telling which approach Joe Biden takes. The news reports seem to indicate he's going to take the political approach. That would be absolutely disastrous and counterproductive, but totally in character with what this administration's incompetence is like.
Mark Thiessen, columnist at The Washington Post, fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, Fox News contributor, former speechwriter for President George W. Bush. Mark, thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
I want to tell everybody that Fox News Radio will provide special coverage of the State of the Union and Republican response as well, beginning at 8:06 p.m. Eastern Time. That is tonight, March 7th, and you can check it out and listen at foxnewsradio.com.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
I'm Emily Campagno, host of the Fox True Crime Podcast. Far too often, women's lives are cut short as they fall victim to unthinkable crimes. But each week this month, I'll be joined by women who fought back, survived, and took back control. You won't want to miss this month's stories of survival, strength, and resilience. Listen and download on Apple, Spotify, and foxnewspodcasts.com.
This is Jason Chaffetz with your Fox News commentary coming up.
Super Tuesday wasn't just about candidates, and what happened in one California city may reflect a more widespread shift. Voters in San Francisco passed two ballot propositions aimed at addressing persistent problems, rising crime and drug use, including addiction in the homeless community, with critics often blaming current conditions on progressive policies.
And it all goes back to many of these new conflicting policies that have not helped with reforms. They have only made San Francisco less safe.
That's Mayor London Breed, a Democrat, announcing in December she would go straight to voters.
What we are introducing today is a change that is necessary, a change that recognizes that we have evolved, a change that recognizes that we want safe streets.
Her proposals that won approval include drug screening for some city welfare recipients and treatment to keep receiving cash assistance through a county program, though sobriety is not a requirement. Changes in police policy and procedure were also approved, giving officers more leeway, allowing them to chase someone believed to be committing a felony or violent misdemeanor. Also allowing police to use drones, facial recognition technology, and to install public surveillance cameras. The San Francisco vote coming just a day after the Washington, D.C. City Council passed a crime bill that also has the effect of rolling back some progressive changes.
We don't want to lock up our kids, but we might have to if they're using guns. All right, it's just that simple. Because not only are they using guns, they're victims of guns.
D.C. Mayor Muriel Bowser calls it common sense legislation that recognizes the importance of accountability. The D.C. bill makes it easier for judges to keep certain violent suspects behind bars before trial, expands the definition of carjacking, and creates a new crime for organized retail theft. It also allows DNA collection after arrests, but after much debate, that's limited to suspects in violent felonies and sexual assault misdemeanors, and only after a judge finds probable cause. Opponents of these shifts in San Francisco and D.C. have some concerns in common, including a focus on penalties instead of help and the potential for disproportionate impacts on minorities. But in both cities, the votes weren't even close.
Look, I think it's an important recognition of, you know, that the last few years have not been working.
Rafael Mangual is the Nick O'Neill Fellow at the Manhattan Institute.
You know, the cynic in me wants to say that the election season has something to do with it. But you know, we'll take what we can get whenever we can get it. You know, I do think these are moves in a positive direction. Is it as far as I would like to see these places go? No, but we got to start somewhere. And I think this is some positive motion.
There is a headline in one piece in the San Francisco Chronicle that says voters make it clear San Francisco can no longer be called a progressive city. Is that overstating what's happening at this point, though, at least in terms of, you know, reversing some of the policies that critics say have helped fuel more crime?
I'd say so. I mean, it sounds to me like that headline's really just an attempt to redefine progressivism, you know, to include, you know, to sort of restrict it to anarchism, right? Even the most progressive people understand that public safety is an important component of how cities function, right? You can't have a functioning society if people cannot take for granted that they're not going to be assaulted or accosted when they leave the house. Otherwise, the economy doesn't work, right? You can't go out and participate. Everyone's stuck in their house.
One of the changes in San Francisco is something that Republicans have historically proposed, a drug testing requirement for welfare recipients. It applies to single adults, no dependents. They would have an addiction specialist and treatment options if they test positive. What about the argument from opponents that this will have deadly results, that some people will end up not getting benefits anymore because they just don't want to do that?
Yeah, I'm not sure there's any evidence to suggest that, right? I think what they're trying to do here is realign the incentives with more positive outcomes, right? You know, we're having trouble getting people into treatment, right? What can we do? Well, we can give them an incentive structure that, you know, really pushes them in this direction. Say, hey, if you agree to get the kind of help that you need, which is probably going to save your life and make the city better, more habitable, etc., we're going to help you in these following concrete ways. You know, I actually think that makes perfect sense.
Another proposal that passed in San Francisco reduces the powers of the Citizen Police Oversight Commission. The mayor says they've been micromanaging the department. But there's some other things that go along with this that are generating some controversy. For instance, more vehicle pursuits will be allowed, right? Drones, surveillance cameras. You know, these raise safety and privacy issues for some people.
could this end up swinging the pendulum back again then? Or at this point, it really depends on whether these changes are effective.
I think it depends on the degree to which the changes are effective. I think it depends on the degree to which these privacy concerns actually arise out of, you know, the use of these technologies. But, you know, provisions like that are really just a recognition of the fact that we're living in a situation in which police departments are running shortages. They are having terrible time recruiting new people into the ranks. They are having a terrible time retaining current members of the force. And so they need to augment their efforts in every way possible. And that means, you know, taking advantage of some of the benefits that these technologies, whether it's drones or surveillance cameras, et cetera, can have. So, this is another example that I think, you know, makes perfect sense. Are there potential, you know, privacy concerns that might arise in the future? Sure. But that's what legislatures are for, right? That's what policymakers are there for. They're there to keep an eye on things and tweak where necessary. What I think we've seen over the past several years is that whenever these concerns arise, right, the political calculus has been that, you know, well, the only politically valuable thing to do is to just blow it all up. That's what's going to, you know, drive fundraising or, you know, whatever it is. And I think, you know, we're seeing the lasting effects of that. And that ends up bringing us back to where we started in some ways.
And in Washington, D.C., the city council is basically rolling back some of what had been done. Giving the police more tools and therefore more power is what it boils down to, including allowing DNA samples to be collected before suspects are convicted so they could be run through a database.
Right. And there's actually good research on why that will help. The Manhattan Institute published a paper by Jennifer Doliak, who's formerly of Texas Tech and now is the VP of Policy at Arnold Ventures, a criminal justice reform shop, just doing a review of the literature showing that expanding DNA databases, you know, by expanding the offenses for which an arrest can result in a DNA swab actually reduces crime in the long run. So, you know, these are all positive developments that are backed by evidence. They're evidence-based, as progressives like to say. So again, I mean, you love to see it. It's a shame that it took this much to get us moving in this direction. But, you know, again, I think it's a positive step and I'll take what we can get.
It feels like a lot's happened in a short time, though, in terms of the things that are leading to some of these reversals and partial reversals, right? I mean, it hasn't been that many years. If we go back to all the racial injustice protests of 2020, I mean, okay, we're getting to the 4-year mark now.
Right.
But still, is that a relatively compressed time frame for things to go back and forth like this?
It's nowhere near as compressed as the time frame for all the changes that took place post 2020. You know, the New York Times did an analysis in April of 2021 showing that since the death of George Floyd, between then and that point, April 2021, so about a year, something like 30 states had passed over 140 police reform bills. That's an enormous amount of movement in a very, very short period of time. I mean, in June of 2020, Governor Cuomo signed 10 different police reform bills into law just a month after George Floyd was murdered. In New York, you know, in less than a decade, we've seen bail reform in 2019, discovery reform in 2019, raise the age in 2018. You had the parole bill, less is more, in 2021 at the city council level. You had the Right to Know Act. You had the diaphragm law, you know, the stop and frisk litigation. All this is like within the last decade, you know, the rewriting of the Rockefeller drug laws. I mean, the list goes on and on and on. So there's actually been quite a lot more movement to the left within the criminal justice and policing policy space that happened in a much more compressed time frame. So I would say this is really a much smaller step in that, you know, direction to where we were compared to all the movement that's taking place. I mean, this doesn't come anywhere close to you know, erasing that progress is, you know, a word I think that they would use for that. But, you know, it doesn't come anywhere close to erasing all that's been done on the reform front.
New York's current Democratic Governor Kathy Hochul has championed revisions to the state's bail reforms aimed at giving judges more discretion to keep some suspects in jail. But yesterday, she turned her attention to transit crime, unveiling a 5-point plan that includes deploying hundreds of National Guard members, state police and transit police, checking bags at busy New York City subway stations after a conductor was slashed in the neck last week.
Now let me just be very, very clear. These brazen, heinous attacks on our subway system will not be tolerated.
She's also proposing to ban violent offenders from the transit system.
Well, again, I mean, it's pretty amazing what an election season will do to politicians who have previously spent a lot of their political capital moving us in a direction that I think a lot of people would say has undermined policing and public safety, not just in the subways or in the city of New York, but in the country writ large. I mean, again, you know, she deserves credit for recognizing that there was a problem and taking affirmative steps to address that problem. You know, I do worry about the degree to which, you know, National Guardsmen who aren't really trained police officers, you know, haven't been trained within the subway system, right? Don't necessarily understand the intricacies of the subway system. I'd much rather see a larger investment in the Transit Bureau of the NYPD to hire more high qualified officers who are going to be specifically trained to do this kind of work. You know, Commissioner Bill Bratton, who first came to New York as chief of the Transit Police Department when it was a separate department from the NYPD, recently tweeted, while he commends Governor Hochul's initiative here, you know, it's important to understand that the NYPD's Transit Bureau is operating with something like 1,000 fewer officers than he had when he was chief of the Transit Department in 1990. So, you know, I think the problems that we have are very clear. They're very clearly traceable to two things, and that is an undermining of the efforts of the police that we have, both through a reduction in their overall force sizes, but also just in the additional restrictions that they have to face, right? Again, you know, police officers who make an arrest anywhere in the city are still subject to criminal penalties if they simply put pressure on somebody's diaphragm, back or chest or neck in any way, even if they didn't mean to do that, and even if that suspect is actively resisting.
On the issue of police tactics, yeah, I did want to ask you about the revision in the DC bill. They revised the definition of an officer chokehold. That is something the police union wanted. How did that come to fruition when there's still so much tension on that issue? And do you think that that is indicative of, you know, other changes that could be coming?
Yeah, I mean, my understanding of the revision, it's not, you know, it's just addressing the vast vagueness in the provision as it stands right now. So it's not legalizing, you know, all neck restraints. You know, but the reality is that there's actually a good bit of research on the use of neck restraints. They're not particularly deadly. They're not particularly dangerous. They're a very effective grappling technique that could actually help de-escalate. And yeah, that sounds weird to people, right? When they hear, well, how can a chokehold de-escalate, right? Isn't that escalate? It's like, well, if you don't effectively grapple a resisting suspect, that suspect may be able to get to a gun or to a weapon. And that interaction may now devolve to a point of more serious force than a chokehold actually being used, where you could have avoided all that by effectively holding that person down. You know, so I think this is one of these examples where we have to trust the men and women who are actually tasked with arresting people. They know what they're doing. They know what they're talking about. Does that mean that, you know, they don't ever abuse their authority? Of course not. Does that mean that there shouldn't be any oversight? Of course not. But we should be guided by research and evidence.
Rafael Mangual with the Manhattan Institute, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Meet the American who
first achieved sainthood. Elizabeth Ann Bailey was born August 28, 1774, in colonial New York City. Despite being a melting pot of new settlers, New York City was on the brink of rebellion and battling infectious disease. Bailey's parents were prominent members of the Episcopal Church, and her father, Richard, was the city's first chief health officer. In 1794, Elizabeth married William McGee Seton, and shortly after, he fell ill. A few short years later, in 1803, the young couple traveled to Italy with their eldest daughter, Anna Maria, to hopefully aid his recovery. However, Seton died of tuberculosis 2 days after Christmas. Elizabeth and her daughter returned to New York as devout Catholics, to the horror of her close friends and family. On March 14, 1805, Bailey was received into St. Peter's Church and made her first communion 11 days later. At the time, St. Peter's was the only Catholic church in New York City. After being ousted by her friends and family, Elizabeth moved her five children to Maryland, where she devoted her life to Christ. She would go on to form a Catholic school for girls and the first sisterhood in the United States, Sisters of Charity of St. Joseph's, who would go on to send missions across the United States. In 1934, her sister Gertrude Korzendorfer of New Orleans made a full recovery from pancreatic cancer deemed inoperable by doctors after beseeching the aid of Mother Elizabeth Ann. Then Anne Teresa O'Neill, just 4 years old, was cured of acute lymphatic leukemia in Baltimore on Easter week in 1952. Most famously, in 1963, a 61-year-old Carl Callan awoke from a coma after a sliver of Elizabeth's bone was brought to the hospital to reinforce the prayers. She died on January 4, 1821, in Emmitsburg, Maryland, at just 46 years old, 201 years after she was born. Mother Elizabeth Ann Seton was canonized on September 4, 1975, after becoming the first woman saint. The incredible acts of healing, each one unexplained by science, propelled her to sainthood more than a century after a brief life filled with incredible drama and achievement.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network.
I'm Janice Dean, Fox News senior meteorologist. Be sure to subscribe to the Janice Dean Podcast at foxnewspodcast.com or wherever you listen to your podcasts. And don't forget to spread the sunshine.
Subscribe to this podcast at foxnewspodcasts.com.
It's time for your Fox News commentary. Jason Chaffetz. What's on your mind?
The obstacle course facing President Biden's State of the Union address tonight presents a formidable challenge. It may prove difficult for the 81-year-old president to navigate. Expectations could not be lower. Biden faces the usual challenges of exaggerating his paltry policy wins, justifying his substantial missteps, and attacking his political opponents. But those questions may be overshadowed by more basic ones. Can he make it from start to finish gaffe-free? Will we be able to understand his words? Will this be one of the shortest addresses ever? Will he even be able to find his way off stage? Keep in mind, if he has a senior moment this time, the Easter Bunny won't be there to save him. We need a commander-in-chief who can negotiate. In this case, negotiate the steps to the podium, a smaller teleprompter, and staying awake after sundown. But there are also very real questions about his ability to negotiate to avoid war in the Middle East, de-escalate conflict in Ukraine, stop millions from pouring over our borders, including countless criminals, and preserve our access to affordable energy and health care. Perhaps he pulls it off, but a two-minute video released on his X account in February raised eyebrows when readers identified at least 29 jump cuts. That raises the question, can Biden still form coherent sentences in a live setting, and for how long? Will he ad-lib and start dishing out a Kamala Harris-style word salad? Despite vociferous assurances from the press secretary, Karine Jean-Pierre, that he passes a cognitive test every day, he likewise seems to generate new questions about his competence nearly as often. His obvious cognitive decline is being lampooned around the world, including a recent viral skit from Italy. The justification to elect President Biden was supposed to be his ability to work with Congress, where he served for decades. We were told he could bring the nation together, working with world leaders he claims he knows so well. But on all those fronts, after 3 years, President Biden has failed. No doubt Biden will predictably point blame at Republicans. He'll take numerous shots at Donald Trump. That's cheap, easy, and definitely going to happen. It is an election year, after all. But Biden's biggest obstacle will be his tenuous relationship with reality and truth. Gaslighting is his best hope. Biden will claim a vibrant economy. But no matter what his manipulated statistics say, Americans know their own budgets. Biden will blame climate change for everything, including the flood of illegal border crossers. Americans know that is not true. He will say democracy is under attack, but America is aware that Democrats are the ones trying to prohibit his opponent from even being on the ballot. Biden will use the best of what his speechwriters have to offer. They will attempt bold verbal gymnastics to gaslight Americans about his Israel policies, his equity agenda, his open support of censorship, and more. But it will all be at odds with truth and reality, and increasing numbers of Americans see it. And despite his shouting, mixed with occasional whispering, Americans will recognize that the guy first elected in 1972 is out of gas. I'm Jason Chaffetz, Fox News contributor and host of the Jason in the House podcast on the Fox News Radio Network.
You've been listening to the Fox News Rundown. And now, stay up to date by subscribing to this podcast at foxnewspodcasts.com. Listen ad-free on Fox News Podcasts Plus on Apple Podcasts. And Prime members can listen to the show ad-free on Amazon Music. And for up-to-the-minute news, go to foxnews.com. Listen to the all-new Brett Baer podcast featuring Common Ground, in-depth talks with lawmakers from opposite sides of the aisle, along with all your Brett Baer favorites like his all-star panel and much more. Available now at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you get your podcasts.